Thank you, Paco and Jesse. That was beautiful. It's one of those things when you start going into worship like that and you have this beautiful music and you're getting a chance to sing and you just stop and go, you know what, let's just skip the speaker and let's do that for a while. So get back up here. I'm done. I'm all for that. Thank you, guys. That was beautiful. Tonight, we're going to start with a question because somebody asked me as I was coming in a question about the difference between the heart and the soul. And I said, well, just interrupt me. And I thought, no, that'll go really bad. I'll get distracted. So we're going to address this really quick, knowing that if I do it fast enough, you'll think I have a better answer. If I took more time, I don't. This is all I've got for it. But when you study the soul, there's a lot of different diagrams that people try to break out the different parts of who we are in our humanity. And there's some that are three circles that go together. If you know Venn diagrams where they overlap, that type of thing, you've got that type of illustration. There's some where it's just two parts. There's some that are three parts. There's some that have different legs that go off and, you know, kind of like a spider. And you're thinking, we're not spiders. That doesn't work. But there, you can just about pick up one of your own and decide if that makes you understand it better, great. The one that really clicks with me is one that kind of lays out the pattern in opposition to things. So if you're going to have to use your imagination, I don't have a dry erase board here to draw it, but put the soul right in the middle. That's the part that lives on forever. That's the part that remains. That's the part that we're telling you when the Lord stops and says, tonight your soul will be required from you. All those other parts he's not holding you accountable for. He's holding you accountable for the soul. So I put that one right in the middle. But then what you do is you take the others, and so if we're talking about heart, then we're going to say, so here's soul in the middle. We're going to put heart in a circle right over here to the side, and mind opposite, that we have the heart and we have the mind, and then we have the flesh, and I'm going to put the flesh down here and the spirit right here. So if you've got four circles around the soul, that's the image that that helps me understand this process. And the difference is we've talked about the spirit and flesh being an opposition, that's pretty clear. And then when we look at the heart and the mind, we know that they are often in opposition, that our mind is telling us one thing and our heart is telling us something else. So we find these things in opposition and our soul is right in the middle and actually has the ability to direct any one of those. That we can check our mind, we can discipline our mind, we can actually settle down our heart, or we can let our heart run wild. We can do the same thing with the flesh, just let the flesh do whatever it wants, or we can surrender to the spirit and allow that spirit to do whatever it calls us to do. So right in the middle, it's the soul that is ultimately responsible for directing all of those. But the question was specifically the difference between the heart and soul. Love the Lord with all your heart, your soul, and your mind, or your might. And so it depends on whether you're New Testament, Old Testament, which passage, which translation, how it goes. And so we could spend all night just on those three to four words that are used. But again, the question was difference between heart and soul. So more clearly, we know what a mind is. We know what a body is. We know what spirit is. So now if we go over to just the heart part, the heart is that kind of the seat of the emotions. That's where the things that we feel play out. So it's the things that happen to us. Something can happen. A car can pull in front of us and we suddenly get angry and we're flooded with emotions and we respond to those emotions. Sometimes we use our flesh and sometimes we use our mind and sometimes we actually use our soul. Sometimes the spirit speaks to us and we use the spirit, but it's that thing of emotions, and sometimes it's love, sometimes it's anger, sometimes it's fear, sometimes it's sadness. But to put it in perspective, Jeremiah 17 says, the heart is deceitful above all things, who can know it? I, the Lord, search the heart and I try the reins. Reins in the Hebrew actually is the word kidneys. So what God is saying, and this is God speaking, he says, the heart, this one over here, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. I, the Lord, search the heart and I try the kidneys. You're like, what? What is that about? Anybody know what the kidneys do? They filter things. They literally filter the blood, meaning whatever you, the heart being deceitful goes out and does whatever it's doing and tries to justify all kinds of things. I don't know about your heart. My heart does that. Tells me I have made a decision to do this, but I find my heart starting to lead me to do that. And my emotions are starting to get confused and it's deceitful. It deceives me even. God himself says your heart's so deceitful that the way I know what's really going on in you is I actually do a blood test. Actually test your blood to see what emotion has flooded into your body. What is it that your body is actually putting out there and your heart, those emotions start to put through. So here we have a passage that kind of lays it out that says the heart over here is this thing of the seat of the emotions. And sometimes those emotions run rampant. It controls even what we think, or we put the mind aside and we lead just with our emotions. Make sense? That's the difference between the heart and soul. So we could have the same kind of debate about what's the difference between mind and soul, what's the difference between flesh and soul, and then spirit, and go that route. So that's the quick answer on that one. And again, we could pray, be done, let's have another worship song, and we're done. But we do have one last message. This one is just simply, if we're talking about souls, we do have to have a conversation about saving souls. And you just heard the gospel. This is what I love about these videos, and I've had a chance to be a part of videos like this for years. These videos get laid out. We get a chance to share what kids have, what has transpired in kids' lives, adults' lives, but we always make sure I'm saying it as if I'm still here, they always insert a speaker, a pastor, and if you notice, what they do is they always insert one who is right at that crux where they're presenting the gospel. The good news that God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. That's the soul, by the way. And that's the whole thing Hume Lake Christian Camps is built around is the clear presentation of the gospel, the good news and the saving of souls. So that's why I love this place. Because it knows what it's about. It continues to do it. And it says, if we've only got a couple of sound bites to put in, there's some pretty fun ones in there from the kids. But those speakers, that's why you should give money to this place. Because where else do you have it that clear that this is what we're about, this is what we're doing, and you can go over and ask these kids that are out on the lawn tonight and know that they have heard that same message and are responding the same way to a living, loving God who has reached out to them and is calling to their soul, and they were responding in kind. The saving of the souls is what this place is about. But I want to kind of unpack it a little bit and explore it a little bit as far as our responsibility in that and how that plays out. To do this, I want to kind of set up, get your mind thinking through this. But the first thing is paying attention to our soul, which is what we've been doing all week long, is talking about our souls. So this idea of paying attention to our souls, in order to do that, it requires us to pay attention to God. In other words, we're assuming all kinds of things when we say we have a soul that is the part of us that is most important, the part that's going to remain, the part that's going to live forever. That assumes that there's this whole other concept of God and eternity there. We can't have this conversation about the soul if there is no God. If there is no God and you just simply live and die, then all you are is a body. We're done. We've wasted the entire week. We could have been done from the beginning because just go out, eat, drink, and be merry. That's all you've got is this life right now. But the flip side is if there's more, if there's eternity, then there is a God. So at that point, if we're paying attention to our soul, it's going to require us to pay attention to God. He has to enter into this equation. But the problem here is this. If you pay attention to God, it's going to result in having to pay attention to others. If we know that God's primary thing is to, he stops and says, I'm going to set the whole of creation to be about sending my son to die for someone else, to serve others, to love others, and then we get involved with that God and his primary thing is to love others. Is there anybody here that doesn't think that if you hang around with him, you remember our five-chimp rule? If you hang around God and you think about God and you pay attention to him, it's going to affect you. It's going to start implicating that you've got a role in this. So if you turn to Proverbs 24, we're going to start with this. And this is pretty basic. Again, it may very well be a verse you know well, but Proverbs 24, and we're going to jump in at verse 10. Proverbs 24:10. If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. Rescue those who are being taken away to death. Hold back those who are stumbling to the slaughter. If you say, behold, we did not know this, does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? Does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it? And will he not repay man according to his work? Rescue those who are being taken away to death. That's a commandment. And it says, don't be slack in it. That one of the things for us is we should be about rescuing those who are stumbling, staggering, being led to death. Is that only physical death? Or if we know the most important part of us is the soul, doesn't it mean, isn't he really alluding to what's happening with that question with our souls, with their souls? Then more important than just saving lives is actually saving souls. And again, we talked about it a couple nights ago, that sometimes you have to save their life to be able to do the work of the soul. We do this in the rescue mission work. Again, the quote is, you can't help somebody with their addiction if they're dead. That means we've got to get involved in their life and work on saving their life first. And once they see our compassion and our love, we share the gospel with them, then we can begin to work on their souls. But that principle, as we see this, it's two things. One, we're being called to actually reach out for their souls, rescue those who are being taken away to death. And then this caution, does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it, know what we're doing? In other words, he puts those two together and says, the very thing I'm watching over is your soul, that part of you that matters most. And what I'm watching is to see what you're doing for others. Are you reaching in to rescue others? So we could do this all night with verses like that. I try not to just bombard you with a ton of scripture, though it's the one thing you can make sure you've never gone wrong on. I'm going to go off script just for a second. There's a great story of A.W. Tozer. When he first started preaching, he was a brand new preacher. He didn't even have a church yet. So he would just do substitute preaching and jump into different pulpits and just to get the practice. So he goes out to this one country church and they let him preach in the morning, and he preaches in the morning and he knows it's bad. He knows he's not connecting. He knows he's not prepared, and he's putting this stuff out there and it just goes bad. He goes to the back of the atrium, and as everybody leaves, they kind of just shake his hand. Nobody says a thing to him about the sermon. But because it's country church, he's supposed to have lunch afterwards, hang out at other people's houses, and preach again at night. And he is not looking forward to it. And sure enough, as it goes into the evening, his second message is worse. He goes to the back and he's just wanting to get out of town really fast. And finally, one older man comes up to him and he makes a beeline to A.W. Tozer and he grabs his hand and he pumps his hand and he says, young man, I can't thank you enough tonight for your words. This was incredible. You have transformed my life. And this spark ignites in A.W. Tozer. He stops and he thinks, this is great. I finally connected with somebody. And he goes, no, it wasn't actually anything you said. It was that verse you read. That verse is still just rattling around inside of me. That verse has cut me to the core. Thank you for reading that verse. And he walks out. A.W. Tozer learned at that moment it didn't matter what he said. What mattered was that scripture was presented and clear. So that's why we'll keep throwing verses at you, so you at least get something out of this talk. All right, I wasn't even supposed to talk about that. Here's the thing about rescuing. Some of you may have read that the shepherd looks at the 23rd Psalm. He talks about in that book, it talks a lot about the soul in there. But the section that talks about reviving the soul, when he talks about it, he says the reason it needs to be revived is because we in our souls constantly go through difficult times. We talked about that a little bit last night, the dark night of the soul, but sometimes it's self-imposed. Sometimes we flip ourselves upside down. He uses that word as a shepherd uses it about sheep, and it's called the casting of sheep. And what happens is sheep get themselves into a position where they're cast. Cast means they're upside down. What happens is they lay down on the ground, and sheep being kind of like us, a little foolish, they lay down and they're all this soft wool on the outside, so they're not even sure where a hard edge is, and they lay down, and if it's sloped a little bit, they just roll right over. and their legs are spinning around and clawing at the air, and they cannot right themselves. And literally, if it's a hot day, it doesn't take long, and that sheep can die within a day just laying on its back. And the only thing that can save that sheep isn't other sheep, it isn't the sheep itself. It's actually the shepherd who looks for those sheep that are cast. The reason why he counts the sheep and that whole illustration of the 99 and he goes after the one is because if he doesn't go after that one is going to die. It's not going to make it. Whether it gets eaten by a wolf or gets cast and is flipped upside down, it needs somebody else to come alongside to right the sheep. And that's where we're at in this case, is that in these scenarios, we have to realize Jesus has left us here to do his work. That there are people that are cast right now in your family, in your circle, in your workplace, in your community, and they are upside down. And we're standing right next to them. Is it possible that we could be part of that? A few years ago, we were about to expand Ponderosa Camp. It was running at about 700 to 750 kids, and we had a huge waiting list of churches and kids that wanted to get into Ponderosa. So we were evaluating the possibility of building a balcony in the Ponderosa Chapel. If we could build a balcony that would seat about 300 kids, we could grow it up to be about 1,000 kids, which is what we're doing right now in Ponderosa, what Hume is doing right now in Ponderosa. Years later, that still stuck with me. But the concept is that when we looked at it, we said, should we do that or should we just build a huge chapel that would seat, I don't know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000? And so there was a question of how high could we go? Because if we had all these kids on the waiting list, why not do more? The energy would be crazy and the whole place would be crazy. We knew that there was a tipping point somewhere, but we didn't know where it was. And we heard about a place called Falls Creek in Oklahoma. So we jumped on a plane. We flew out to Falls Creek. They were running camps with 5,000 kids a week. So we went out to see it. Doing some great ministry, but let me say this. We determined we shouldn't do 5,000 kids a week. I'll just leave that part at that. But what we saw there was this huge, huge outdoor amphitheater covered that could seat 5,000 people. And in it, they began to run this game. And the guy got up front, the speaker got up front and said, okay, here's the deal. We've already passed out to some of you just little slips. And everybody's got a slip. So we all got slips as we walked in. And the slips would say whether you were saved or unsaved, whether you were a Christian or not. And if you were a Christian, your job was to simply go and share your faith with somebody else. And they said, we just want to see how long it takes in order for you to spread the gospel to all 5,000 of you. So they literally gave it to just like 12 people. This is a strange number. I've heard that somewhere before. But they gave it to 12 people and had those 12 just go share the gospel to others. And they went out. They were sent out and they began to share the gospel. And I know we were sitting kind of up and to the left and we were sitting there watching this little buzz and people talking and everything else. And there was like 10 minutes for the time to see if we could evangelize the entire 5,000 camps in 10 minutes. At the end of the 10 minutes, we were really sad we were still unsaved. A fascinating thing happened. When the people went, they went to the people that they knew, their friends. They went up to a friend and they said, are you saved or unsaved? And they looked at their slip and they said, well, I'm unsaved. And they go, all right, let me share the gospel with you. And they'd show their gospel. And then they got all excited and they hugged each other and went, let's go get. And they got their next friend and they said, well, are you saved? And they'd share with them. And then once they got their whole group, they jumped up and down and they were so excited and they were talking about it. And they stopped right there. And literally, we were maybe 3 minutes in and the activity stopped. And it was fascinating to watch that even as believers recognized that the others out there were perishing, were being led to the slaughter, they were cast, that even in that picture, they just simply stopped. Because the people they cared most about were the ones that they were working on, and after that, it didn't matter. And it was really troubling to watch. One, because I was unsaved. I never heard the gospel that day. But this is the principle, is it's not just in that game, it's real in life, is that once we know we're safe, and especially if we think our family's safe, we then don't carry the responsibility of everyone else. But this is what this passage is saying. It says we're actually responsible for this. Remember our 2020 vision? We talked about that last night. Flip back, if you can, to John 20. We're going to take one more little look at it, because that concept playing out here, and you'll remember we talked about, we think that Mary went looking for Jesus. She goes to see the body of Jesus to take care of it, finds out it's been moved, and she's really sad about it. And remember, the angels were giddy. They were all excited to, you know, surprise her. And, you know, you almost wonder if they wanted to go boo and just jump out at her and go, no, no, just kidding. You know, but then they're thinking, nah, this is the tomb. That could really freak her out. Then it's going to get written about. We're not going to get another, you know, gig like this. So I'm reading a lot in between. But the bottom line is that we have this principle here that's really, really important for us to notice. And so if you look at John 20 and verse 16, Jesus said to her, Mary, that's when she recognizes that it's Jesus. She turned and said to him in Aramaic, Rabboni, which means teacher. And Jesus said to her, do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers. What I want you to see right there is Mary's first response when she realizes this is Jesus, he's raised from the dead, is that she just stops and goes right to him. And hangs on to him because this is Jesus. This is wonderful. I now have him in my arms and I'm never going to let you out of my arms again. We get that. We totally resonate with what she did. And Jesus' words are, this is not about you recognizing you're safe. I need you to go because there are others who have not yet heard. Do you see that there? Then he goes to the disciples. Remember that? He passes through the wall. He shows his wounds, his scars. He does that whole thing. And now look at it here. What does he say to them? This is the tail end of verse 21. Jesus said to them again, peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, even so I am sending you. Jesus, right off the bat, the first two things that he does, he goes to Mary and says, you need to go. He goes to the disciples and he says, you need to go. Guess what he's saying to us? We need to go. This is the 2020 vision, this part and parcel of what's going on here. I gave this quote a couple of days ago, but it's from Albert Schweitzer, and he says, the most difficult thing that I've ever had to do was to follow the very guidance I prayed for. The most difficult thing I've ever had to do was to simply follow the guidance that I actually prayed for. In other words, like I said earlier, if we pay attention to the soul, we have to pay attention to God in the process. But if we pay attention to God, God's going to start messing with our life. If we hang out with him, he's going to start saying, go, go. And so Albert Schweitzer says this thing, when I pray for guidance and I actually talk to God, God then talks back. And as he talks back, now I'm left with responsibility actually doing what I prayed for. Lord, what do you want me to do in this situation? Really? Do you really want to ask? Well, no, maybe no. No, I'm not sure I want to ask. So here's the concept. We're going to go start with the principle that there is a God. And if the God is active and involved in our life, we do have this sense that we call out to him, that we can talk to him and that he hears us. So first one is there is a God. Number two is that we can talk to him. And number three is that he talks back. We have to start with this assumption. Because if there isn't a God, we don't need this conversation. If there is a God and he doesn't hear us, then it doesn't almost matter that there's a God, because if we talk to him, he's not listening anyway. So we come forward and we know from Scripture that he not only hears, but that he does engage and speak back with us. Those three principles put us down to this place where we're left with this concept that we think that God may one day use us to change the world. Some great opportunity. Maybe in some way, God's going to use us in some powerful way. He's going to give us an opportunity to do great things. But in reality, most of the time, God often changes the world through us in small, little opportunities every single day. He doesn't wait for one big one. He stops and says, no, Mary, go right now. Disciples, just go. I'm sending you. He doesn't wait until the big time happens. Think about it. He knows the day of Pentecost is coming when the Holy Spirit's going to come down. All this stuff, like, take a break, guys. Wait until a couple weeks from now. When that happens, that's going to be the great big day, the big opportunity. He doesn't do that. First time he sees them, the first thing he says is go. And he says it's about that, those small opportunities and taking advantage of them right off the bat. In reality, God most often changes the world every single day by inviting all of us, not just Mary and the disciples, all of us to act on small opportunities. So I've told this story before here, but it's just a great illustration of this. Because Hume hires so many different college students to be able to make the summer staff what it is and do the work here, we would constantly have college students who are right at the crux of their own life of trying to decide what's God's will for my life. So it's one of the most often questions with a college student. They're going, I'm trying to determine God's will for my life. What kind of career do I have? You know, what degree should I pursue? Here's what my parents want me to do. Here's what I'm thinking to do. But most often what it means is, should I marry this girl that I think is really cute? But they ask this question all the time about the will of God. And I come back with this basic answer, that God is involved in us all the time. He's trying to talk to us all the time, daily. Read Practice of the Presence with Brother Lawrence. He lays it out that it should be a constant conversation we're having with God. But in that process, if it's constant conversation, then God's whispering to us all the time about what we should do. And we're waiting for the big moment. I'll obey when he shows me what the big one is. When he gives me that big opportunity, now I'm going to jump in. And God's like, you didn't do very well with a small one. Could you do the small one first, and then maybe I'll give you something bigger? And if you don't think he says that, it's like he was faithful in small things. He will reward with. We know this. So at that point, he comes along and shares those things. So I do that with those college students. When they would come in and they would ask about the will of God, I let them talk about all the stuff they were dealing with. And then I would stop and go, well, is it possible that God's asking you to do something really small today and you haven't done it yet? Maybe you could be obedient on the small things. Respond to that voice. If God talks to you, maybe you should listen and actually pay attention to that. You believe there's a God? Yes. You believe you can talk to him? Yes. Do you ever believe he can talk to you? If he can, is it possible that he's whispering in your life right now in small ways? And he's like, what does that mean? What does that look like? And I go, well, for me, at the time, I was the director of the camp. So what that meant was every time I walked through the property, you carry on the burden of what it looks like, whether there's trash on the ground, whether there's a vehicle that's got a big dent in it, or whether somebody's wearing the right staff shirt, those kind of things. Or what kind of music they're playing. Those are the kind of burdens that you carry as the director. So you walk down the street. So I told him, I said, here's how it works. Just earlier that morning, I'm walking down the road right over here. And as I'm walking over by the boathouse, I look down and I see a piece of trash. And I'm thinking, I don't have time. I'm supposed to get over and meet somebody for lunch. And yet I hear this little voice, pick up the trash. No, I'm not going to pick up. I got to pick up the trash. No, I really got to know. Pick up the trash. Ah. And I go back and I pick up the trash and I throw it away and I go to my lunch. So I share that illustration with him, and I go, that voice, just simply to me, is the still small voice of God whispering to me to do the right thing in even the smallest of things. And I said, that'll sound something like that. So we prayed, sent him out. Later on that afternoon, he comes running up to me, and he's all excited. He's going, Jeff, you'll never guess what happened. And I said, you're right. I'm never going to guess. I don't even want to try. Just tell me. So he does. He says, so I'm walking towards the boathouse across the parking lot for the snack shop, and I see a piece of paper. And I'm like, no, that was my illustration. I'm not the voice of God. You're supposed to be listening to God. And he goes, no, I know that. I know that. He says, but what I'm doing is I'm walking along, and I hear this voice, a little small voice. It wasn't audible, but inside of me. And it's like, you should pick up that trash. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to pick up that trash. That's just Jeff's illustration. I'm only thinking that because Jeff said it. And so he says, I kept walking, but the voice didn't go away. And I'm going, no, that's just, I don't need to do that. It's like, pick up the trash. No, really. So he says, this is what happens. I turn around And I bent down and I picked up the piece of trash. And no sooner had I stood up from picking up the trash, and there's a man standing there, and he says, "You must work here." And he goes, "Yes, I do." And he says, "I've been looking around and I've been watching everything go. All these kids that are moving around and they're laughing and they're smiling, and I have no faith in youth of this generation. I feel like they're just all gone to pot. But I look around this place and I'm not even a Christian, but there's something happening here. Could you tell me what it is?" Still small boys. He's asking you to do little things. And we so often put that off. What happens when he asks us daily to be involved in small opportunities and we say no because we're waiting for the big opportunity? By the way, a definition of opportunity is just simply a set of circumstances that make it possible to do something. I think it's important that you understand this, that if you have an opportunity, it's just simply a set of circumstances that make it possible for something else to happen. So if you're given an opportunity, the circumstances are just right, you have a chance to do it. This set of circumstances makes it possible for you to do it. You just have to do it. Got that? If you've ever been involved in real estate, sometimes you get involved in a thing called first right of refusal. Anybody know what that is? First right of refusal. It's the concept that if there's maybe a bid on a property or a contract for something you want to purchase, or it's the idea that you stop and say, "I would like to have first right of refusal. Before anybody else makes a bid on this property, I get the first right to determine it, whether I want to buy it, whether I want to get involved in this opportunity." So that's first right of refusal. You get first shot at it before anybody else does. This is the concept with this still small voice. But let me play it out in a different way. Turn to Luke chapter 10, verse 25. Again, another passage we almost don't need to read, but again, thinking of Tozer, we're going to read it anyway. Luke chapter 10 starts with verse 25. "And behold, a lawyer stood to put him," Jesus, "to the test, saying, 'Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?' And he said to him, 'What is written in the law? How do you read it?' And he answered, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself.' And Jesus said to him, 'You have answered correctly. Do this and you will live.' But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus," and I'm sorry, but we have to say this in the tone, the original intent of what he said,
"And who's my neighbor?"
Because what's he doing? He's throwing it back at Jesus. What does it say? "And love your neighbor as yourself." And he's like, "Well, who's my neighbor?" And you just want to say to the guy, "Shut up." Well, you're talking to Jesus for crying out loud. But this is what he says. He, desiring to justify himself, says to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" And Jesus replies, he tells the story. "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now, by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, he passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion," not comparison, remember that. Sorry. "He had compassion. He went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he sent him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and he gave them to the innkeeper, saying, 'Take care of him. And whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back.' Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?" And he said, "The one who showed him mercy." And Jesus said to him, "You go and do likewise." Remember that? That's what Jesus does. You go, do likewise. But here's the point and the principle. Right of first refusal. Do you realize this is a story about the right of first refusal? Do you realize the priest was given the right of first refusal? Here's a guy beat up on the side of the road, and the priest gets the first shot at it. He gets the chance to have all that glory where Jesus tells the story about him. But he doesn't act on that. He doesn't take that opportunity that's put in front of him. Neither does the Levite. It's the Samaritan. Now, this has been taught 1,000 different ways for different things. But for this point tonight, I want you to realize there are no good priest hospitals. There are no good Levite hospitals. There are only good Samaritan hospitals. Seriously. Because of the right of first refusal, they didn't act when the opportunity was right there in front of them. But the Samaritan did, and he got it. He's the third string. The priest had first right of refusal, and he opted out. He let it go. The Levite had the opportunity, and he opted out, and he let it go. And the Samaritan looked at it and said, "Nah, I'm in." And he acted on it. He saw the need. He felt compassion in his heart, and he acted. We have opportunities in front of us daily. And the point of it is we think we're going to get a chance at the big opportunity. But quite frankly, we succeed when we act on the small opportunities. We've passed people on the side of the road before. Now the question is, all right, are you going to now pass somebody on the side of the road on the way down the hill? And you're going to go, "No, that's just what Jeff said." And you're going to think it's like the kid with the trash. That's between you and God. I'm going to let you work that one out. But there are good Samaritan laws, there are good Samaritan hospitals, there are good Samaritan clubs. We could go on and on about how the world has grabbed a hold of the value of the person who actually acts on the opportunity. This is a beautiful thing, unless we're the one that passes on the opportunity. Opportunities are important, and they play out just this way. One more big verse here, Galatians 5:13. We read this the other night. I want to come back to it. Galatians 5:13, "For you were called to freedom, brothers, only do not use your freedom as opportunity." So here's the thing about opportunity. We're given opportunities for good, and now we're talking about another opportunity. We have had Christ die for us, so we are now free from all the wages of sin and death. We've got this whole new life. And so he says, great, you got this freedom, but listen to what he says. "Do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself." That even here, it's saying you have opportunities. Don't take the opportunities that are always good for you. Do the opportunities that allow you to serve another. Again, we could go all throughout Scripture and tell this story 1,000 different ways. "Have this mind in you, which was also in Christ Jesus." We would go on and on. He laid down his life. That's the same mindset we should have. Looking for opportunities to serve others. Believing that there is a God that we can talk to and he talks to us. That sometimes in those moments, he gets us that ability to act. There's a really short story about Winston Churchill that I just love. I didn't want to get it wrong, so I just brought it so I can read it to you. But it's this idea of our role in life, sort of. What the story's about is something else entirely. But it's the idea that we are a city on a hill. That concept is that we talk about a light. That's the Matthew 5 passage. "And let your light so shine before men that when they see your good works, they will praise your Father who is in heaven." That's what our life is supposed to be, is a bright light to those around us. That's an opportunity. So this story. As a young lady, Violet Asquith met Winston Churchill at a dinner party, where he ignored her most of the evening. When he finally turned to her, it was to ask her an unexpected question. "How old are you?" 19, she said. "And I," said Churchill despairingly, "I am 32 already, older than anyone else who counts." Which I love that. He then launched into an impromptu commentary on Isaiah's observations. "Curse our mortality, curse ruthless time. How cruelly short is the allotted span for all that we must cram into it." The Isaiah 40 passage that talks about it's just like grass. And it withers and fades away. He goes into all of this with a lady and how cruelly short that this allotted lifespan is and how we must cram into it. And he says, "We are worms, all worms." And then with the Churchillian confidence in his own transcendent uniqueness, he says, "But I do believe that I am a glowworm." I love that. I love that about Churchill. But that's what we are. We're all worms. We're miserable, weak, feeble, inept, incapable, and he gives us first right of refusal. All of us little worms, but we are glowworms. We have this little bit of the light of eternity already planted inside of us, and it's just simply that little light that all he's asking us to shine. He's not asking us to be fantastic and wonderful in 800 ways. He's saying, will you just let that light shine in those small little ways that I ask you? If he whispers to you to be obedient here, here, or here, do those little things. He will send you. That's what we know every time we look at it. He's sending somebody. As the Father sent me, so send I you. So you're in trouble. He's going to do this with you. All right. When we left Hume, the decision to go to Seattle came with a verse and a sense of calling that came fairly clear to us from God. It came from a verse that said, Jeremiah 29:7, that says, seek the welfare of the city where I am sending you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf. For in its welfare, you will find your welfare. We were praying about several different job opportunities, and the one that most aligned with going to a city that where we felt like we'd be in exile was Seattle. It rains in Seattle. That's exile. It was really clear. It was a city. It was a place that we felt like it was far away. It was a place that we weren't used to. It didn't feel like home. It felt like exile. And as we prayed about it, we felt like God was calling us to Seattle. So we went. And I shared this already, that we'd never been in Seattle, never been in a rescue mission. We're thinking, Lord, why are you sending us to Seattle? But in the process, over the years, we keep seeing more and more God using the mission, using the people that we're working with, and sometimes using us to be a part of the process. So this last year, when we were talking about clearing out that jungle area, at one point, we're in a press conference, and the mayor has called for this press conference, and the mayor comes up, and he does his little bit and says his few things about what this cleaning out of the jungle will be, and there are like 25 media outlets there. There are TV cameras, there are radio, there's print ad or print newspapers that are all taking questions and things like that, but the mayor gives up and gives his little speech, and then he steps and says, you know what, I don't have time for the rest of the press conference, so I'm going to step out, and these three right here are going to answer all the questions. And the three were the chief of the fire department, which why he's addressing a homeless thing is a long story, but the press didn't want to talk to him. And then it was the head of human services, which is more of like a career public official, which gives just the same old answers every time they're asked, and nobody wanted to talk to them. And then there's me. And we're going to do the outreach for cleaning out the jungle. So as soon as the mayor walked away, all 25 media outlets came straight to me. One of the first questions was in context to something that had happened just a few days earlier. Once the story had come out that we were going to be the prime outreach tool for clearing up this systemic problem in the city of Seattle, literally 400 to 500 homeless people living under about a 2-mile stretch, again, crime, really bad area. Firefighters would not even go in unless they had police escort. We would go in all the time without either, without firefighters or police escort. It was something that we did because we felt called to it. So we'd already been there. We knew it well. But as soon as the rest of Seattle heard about this, you can imagine some people don't think the world of Seattle's Union Gospel Mission. In a city that doesn't actually believe there's a God and is very unchurched, they looked at it and said, not our favorite place. And now the city's partnering with the Christians to do this? So one of the guys that was a big vocal opponent to this whole process was being interviewed by the local NPR station and simply said, the real headline here is that you have an openly gay mayor, Mayor Ed Murray, he's openly gay, and he says you have an openly gay mayor who's partnering with a homophobe organization. That would be us. We're not homophobes, but that's the way the world casts Christians. Because we believe in the moral values that are laid out in this book, it says that you shouldn't be involved in homosexual activity, that it's not necessarily good for you, and it's against God's law. We look at that and think that that's still actually true. So because of that, we're cast that way. And at that point, that's the first question I get asked in the press conference. So here I am, 25 media outlets come pressing against me, and then the microphone comes and is pushed into my face with the question, all right, this Tim Harris guy says that the real headline here is that openly gay mayor partners with homophobe organization. What do you have to say about that? And I'm thinking, nothing. I don't want to say anything about that. Let's talk about something else. How about the weather? You know, it's like anything else at that moment. But I believe there's a God, and I believe that I can talk to him. And I believe that he can talk back. So I throw up a quick prayer, because the first thing that happens in my mind is I try to get out of it. Well, I'll just be clear that my first answer was, no, this is really about cleaning out the homelessness, that kind of thing. And he goes, no, you're not addressing the question. The real question here is, openly gay mayor is partnering with a homophobe organization. What do you have to say about that? So my first thought, I'm sarcastic and I have a really bad sense of humor. So in my mind, I'm wanting to go, the mayor's gay? When did that happen? And I am so close to doing it. And this still small voice is going, don't say it, don't say it, don't say it. Now at this moment, I don't know if the still small voice is actually God or my wife, because she has that same effect on me. Like, Jeff, don't say that, don't say that, don't say that. I heard both, maybe. So I didn't say it. But what the voice said to me at that point, this whispering of the Spirit inside of me, was, Jeff, there's the truth. And I'm like, what does that mean? Where is the truth? And here's the cameras, and they're all rolling. And it was like, oh. So I said, you know, it's not news that the mayor's gay. In other words, the mayor's gay was actually the truth. This isn't shocking that the mayor's gay, nor is it shocking that the mission is Christian. So that's what I said. I said, it's not news that the mayor's gay. It's not news that Seattle's Union Gospel Mission is Christian. We've been around for 85 years. Everybody knows what we do. What's news is in a city that celebrates diversity, as you have two unique groups coming together to address a systemic problem that's plagued our city for over 35 years. That's what I did. I'm like, oh, that's good. That's really good. I had never thought that thought before. I had never said those words before. But in this process of saying, I believe there's a God, I believe I can talk to him, and I believe he talks to me, is in that process, I had that conversation, and he guided me through one of the most difficult moments right then and there. I love that about him. What I don't love about him is that he makes me stand in front of 25 newspapers and answer those questions. But this is the concept of the first right of refusal. He gives us a chance to step into places where he's going to do work. He wants to invite you into those. So when he says, Mary, go, don't cling to me, go. You've already seen that I'm alive, now go tell others. How often we get into the comfort of our Christian circles and cling to Jesus. And he's going, yeah, I'm glad you love me. Now go. Go do. Go tell. Go share. Go be a glowworm. A couple nights ago, we said, be the boy. Now I'm going to say, be the glowworm. Be a boy that glows. Figure that out for yourself. I don't know what that means. Galatians 5. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. I want to close with one last story. And some of you may have heard this story over the years. It's been passed along. But they're in Hawaii. As Western European settlers began to come into Hawaii, they brought a lot of their diseases with them to a tribe and a native people that did not have any exposure to those. They hadn't built up immunities to the basic diseases that we all just kind of have with us all the time. So they spread those diseases, and there was a big die-off on the native people of Hawaii, including leprosy. and leprosy began to break out into Hawaii, and people didn't know yet exactly what it was. They felt that it was highly contagious, so they took anybody that would catch leprosy. And if you don't know what leprosy is, leprosy, though much vaunted in the Old Testament because of the skin disease that it is, it's the type of thing where you lose all the sensitivity and your nerves, so you don't feel anything. So it's not so much that your skin starts falling off and decaying, it's that you don't know that you just shoved your hand into a fire or got it smashed, and so you start destroying the flesh because you don't feel anything. And it eventually destroys your body as it spreads throughout your entire body, or up an extremity, and then you'll get an infection, but you don't know it's infected because you don't feel anything. And so you die from the effects of leprosy. So Hawaii literally took one island, Molokai, and they took a little part of a peninsula off that island that had a big ridge that separated from the rest of the island, and they made it a leper colony. And anytime somebody got leprosy, they sent them to that little outpost of the island. Now, they put these people there without a city being there, and they just stacked them up there. And as it got to be about 800, 850 individuals, there wasn't any city government, there wasn't anybody running anything. So literally, the Catholic Church took a guy by the name of Father Damien, and they sent Father Damien to this place, and he just simply started helping them build roads. He started building organizational structure. He started setting up some schools. He started setting up some hospitals. He would begin to heal their wounds and bandage them up, and he would teach them how to cook and how to care for each other, how to start farms and do different things. And he just lived with them and loved on them until at one point he was boiling up some hot water. This is in the late 1800s. There's no electricity or anything else on this portion of the island. He's boiling up water so that he can take a bath. And as he goes to take the water off the thing, it spills this scalding water and it pours all over his foot. And he feels nothing. And he realizes he has contracted leprosy. And his curiosity, he pours it on his other foot, and he feels nothing. And he watches his skin blister right on the spot with no pain whatsoever. He knows that he has just gotten a death sentence simply because he's gone to do what God called him to do, to love on these people, to not shrink away from them, but actually move towards them and to be near them, to touch them and to hold them and to hug them and to bury them and to minister to them. So he was there for 16 years and he dies and they bury him. They give him a pretty cool gravesite and they bury him. But the story gets out about Father Damien, and so his home country, Belgium, is so excited by what he's done and that he actually gets to go before the process of being a saint. Now he's dead, so he doesn't know any of this. At least not on this side of earth. But in the process, they go and actually inter the body. They dig up his body and take it back to Belgium because now he's a hero. So they bring him to Belgium so that they can have their hero and give him a homecoming. So he gets buried in Belgium. Right up until just about 20, 25 years ago, the people from Molokai finally, after years of besieging the Belgian government, said, "Hey, we need him back." And they were like, "You can't have him back. He's our saint." And they said, "Oh, we don't want all of him. We just want his right hand." Now, at first you hear that and you think, that's kind of creepy. And they simply followed up and they said, "No, we just simply want the part that he reached out and touched us with. That was the part that made all the difference to us, was the part of him that didn't hesitate to touch us. They just wanted his right hand." I love that story. I love that story because Father Damien had first right of refusal. How easy it would have been to say, "No, I'm not going to a leper colony. I'm not going to leave my family and go off to some Pacific island. Why, maybe, but not to a leper colony." He didn't hesitate. And once there, when he saw their needs, he moved towards them. He moved at them because he believed God was calling him. He was giving him an opportunity. He was going to go do that. While he was on that island, no one knew his name. While he was on that island, it was really hard to get the Catholic Church to support him in anything, to get funds to do anything. He couldn't get the Hawaiian government to get behind him. He was not a hero while he was alive. It was afterwards that the people of Molokai stopped and said, "No, that man changed our life," because while he was there over 16 years, many of them came to know Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. They too still had leprosy, but they now had their soul in a place that even that night when their soul was required of them, they would know Jesus. It wasn't about leprosy. It was about that small glow inside of us that is the small light of eternity that is in each of us. And we desperately need to be a city set on a hill, a light that's shining to a world in darkness. He sent Mary, he sent the disciples, and he's sending each of us. When he whispers to you, I simply encourage you to act on that first right of refusal. Let me pray for us.